accession number 20457, reel 33.
Brigadier Randall, reel 33. You were discussing the way in which the tour of Tunisia had been organised through the Marath Line. Do you know if the battlefield tour of Italy was organised on the same sort of basis?
I think it was, yes. I mean, the essential thing is to have a very thorough reconnaissance, both from the actual area you're going to look at, and of course from an administrative point of view. A very careful selection of your guest speakers in the stand. I mean, like most things in this world, it's my experience is it's the amount of what goes into the preparation that matters. And particularly on a battlefield tour, you really do have to have a very, very thorough prior reconnaissance in considerable detail. You can't play it off the cuff. And so it did involve a lot of people going out and getting people together and going right through it, each stand, and then getting your transport right and all those sort of things. But basically, I mean, it followed the same idea. I don't think there's any alternative, really. If you were dealing with more experienced commanders, well then you might say, well, here's the situation. You run it like a tute. You've got a quarter of an hour to decide your plan. But then that wasn't the object of the exercise in this case. It was merely to paint a picture of what war is really like to a lot of young officers, rather than to teach them how to become generals. I'm not saying they shouldn't be taught at some stage, but this wasn't the object of the exercise then.
Do you know if that policy of yours was followed on when you took up your next appointment? Was it did it plant a seed that flourished?
I think we had one of the periodical sort of financial crises. And I suppose at the end of the day, battlefield tours for young officers could be put in the highly desirable category rather than the essential one. They were quite expensive in terms of hotel and that sort of thing. And of course, there were no private soldiers involved. I went on elsewhere, but I don't think John Tubby Butler, John Moggs, was quite so interested in them. I don't know. I don't think so.
As far as I remember, John Moggs was very interested in keeping the one to Normandy going, wasn't he?
Yes. That didn't seem to feature in my mind. I think the Staff College obviously ran its own show. Mm. We were aware going on, but they lived. Staff College rather lived in its own little world centre. So we didn't really have any. I didn't have any control over that. Or I think it's a pity that they didn't continue. But I don't seem to think so. After I left, the place was reorganised. In any case, it used to be the Army Strategic Command.
Yes.
United Kingdom Land Forces.
Yes.
And the whole sort of it was just all units in the UK. Army Strategic Command just consisted of all the fighting troops, and therefore the training priorities changed quite a lot too, I think.
Another thing I think you mentioned was amphibious training.
I was responsible for that.
Did that involve liaison with the Navy and with the Royal Marines? Or
I had on my staff a G1 and a G2,
yes.
Using the old-fashioned terms, SO1 and SO2, who were charged simply with amphibious training.
Yes.
And we did actually, we did have one major amphibious exercise involving the 3rd Division. It took place over in Northern Ireland.
What scale was it? How many soldiers did you have actually landing?
I can't remember now. We just had Fearless and Intrepid, I think.
Yes.
Who were, I think, fairly. They're still going out there, but they were fair. So I think it was It was about a brigade group landed, I think, and yeah. then there were sort of enemy forces already there. It was a sort of it was a two brigade sort of do, I think.
So it was an assault landing and opposed landing, assault
that
landing.
That was right. Mm. Yes, I'm a bit vague about it now, but it was deemed quite a success. Mm. Obviously, there was liaison with the Navy. There was a naval liaison officer at Headquarters Army Strategic Command. And I, laying on this, it was laid on, the detail was laid on by GOC, the 3rd Division, what was that, Gunner, Major General. But I got involved in it a lot, and we had to go down to conferences at Portsmouth quite a bit, and that sort of thing. But then, the people training is a thing. Every night, suddenly everybody thinks, "Oh, it's the thing. I must do it." And then you do it, and then it gets put on the back burner, and nobody really worries about it again for 2 or 3 years. And I had this quite high powered sort of G1 with not doing very much, so I gave him another job to do, which he quite liked. He's a very close personal friend of mine now, but he said, "I'm G1 amphibious." I said to him, "No, you're not, David. From now on, you're going to do this. Get yourself out to Bermuda." He said, "Well, that's different." But my guess is that every now and again, people have a thing, well, amphibious training, big thing to do with the army, and then you do an exercise, and then it does really sort of fade away.
Yes.
And I think, of course, nowadays, I don't know what happens now, but I may get the impression nowadays all most amphibious things nowadays are done by the Royal Marines, and the army don't get involved at all. But in those days, the army certainly did have a role.
Do you remember which part of Ireland the
well, it was County Down.
Yes.
The sort of Newcastle, all around that area there. So I can't remember exactly where they landed.
Do you remember whose idea it was to do it at that time? Was it again an idea you had, or was it an idea down the line?
See, before John Morgue was, I don't know. I think the Navy were quite keen to do it.
Mm.
I think, and the 3rd Division had been given this amphibious thing, so I think the GOC of the 3rd Division decided, well, we must do it. It certainly wasn't my idea, though I was heavily involved.
Well, because 3rd Division had landed on Sword Beach on D-Day, they had a history of, a remote history of assault landing.
Yes, oh yes. Mm. It was quite a useful exercise. I'm not quite sure why we picked Norland. I think generally I got the impression that landowners in Northern Ireland were a bit easier, a bit more welcoming of the army than they would be if you landed. And it isn't such a holiday resort. I mean, you just imagine a whole lot of troops were landing somewhere down the south coast in September. I mean, it wouldn't be very popular.
No, no.
So that was one of the factors, that it had to be an area where it wouldn't interfere too much with the sort of tourist life and where the farmers and people. So that was one of the main factors. And it did involve a proper sort of. I did it once in an amphitheatre, but we got on a Portsmouth and just went out to sea for about a couple of miles and came in. Well, that slightly lost its realism, but I mean, we had to go through the whole part of the exercise was not only the actual business of Northern Ireland, but the whole procedures
for mounting.
For mounting it. Mm. That was the important thing, but not only to train the soldiers, but to train the staffs in the peculiarity of staff work involved in mounting amphibious exercise. That was quite I do remember that was an important part of it. Mm. Because it involved the Navy quite a bit too. I think we actually used Devonport in the end. I can't remember whether Devonport or Portsmouth. Mm. But anyway, that was important part of the exercise, was the mounting as well as the actual sort of landing. And once you've got ashore and that sort of thing, it just became another sort of another land exercise. It went through so that the soldiers weren't bored, but one thing got ashore and all that sort of business, and most of the lessons had been learned. Then, of course, there was a resupply and that sort of thing.
Do you remember?
I'm really vague about it now, but I mean, I think it was a valuable exercise.
Do you remember if you had any sort of joint staff team set up with the Navy for?
Oh yes,
you
did. Oh yes, mm. They've all done it. Very much so. Oh yes.
What about the Air Force? Did the Royal Air Force play?
I think they played their part too. I mean, it was a joint service exercise.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. And I, again, 30 years ago now, I can't remember the detail of it, but. I mean, it wasn't just a sort of off-the-cuff sort of, let's get the boats out this afternoon, boys. I mean, a lot of time, trouble, and money went into it. And I think it was properly done. And lessons, I think valuable lessons were learned, actually.
Can you remember roughly how long it took to actually plan it and set it up before it went?
Well, I think it took about 6 months or so, at least, I think. I mean, I seem to remember that they had I mean, this G1 I had, and his G, he was a gunner, and then his G2 was a Royal Marine officer. I mean, they were really very heavily involved. They were always going down to meetings and that sort of thing. I had other responsibilities. I deliberately couldn't get myself too bogged down into it. I mean, I wasn't, you know, I had other jobs and simply running this exercise. But, there was certainly. I certainly went down to one big meeting, I remember, somewhere down at Portsmouth, somewhere with a whole lot of naval officers to make sure that they were getting from us what they wanted and we were getting from them what we wanted. And it all went off very amicably, actually. Quite a lot of gin was drunk in the wardroom. But it was a valuable exercise, I think, and I think the people who took part enjoyed it too. It was something a bit different.
I think after Army Strategic Command, you then moved to the headquarters of the Prince of Wales Division at Lichfield.
Yeah, well, I was promoted.
Yes.
To take over, as you said, Divisional Brigadier at the Wales Division.
And I think that there you were Divisional Brigadier. What does a Divisional Brigadier do? What are his
Well, it was
duties?
A fairly new concept, dreamt up by Field Marshal Lord Carmel.
Yes.
So the infantry had been, not from a training point of view, but from an administrative point of view, the infantry regiments had been grouped together in brigade groups, and everything called the brigade colonel was responsible for the detailed postings of regimental officers and things like quartermasters and making recommendations in conjunction with colonels and regiments for commanding officers, and he also had a responsibility for the retraining of recruits. And there were dotted about, in our case, there was the Wessex Brigade, and there were all the regiments had these brigade colonels. It was deemed by Lord Carver and by the MOD that this needed reorganisation, so they grouped together three or four of these brigade groups into divisions, and they upped the commander to a brigadier. So, as Divisional Brigadier, I was responsible directly for the career planning of the officers of the old Wessex Brigade, the Devonshire and Dorset Regiment, the Royal the Duke of Edinburgh's, the Gloucesters and the Hampshires. There were two Welsh regiments, Royal Welsh Fusiliers and the Royal Regiment of Wales, and what the Mercian, old Mercian Brigade, which was the Staffords, the Worcester and Sherwood Foresters, and the Cheshires. Now, each of those old groups had a brigade. Depot commanded by a lieutenant colonel. There was one at Exeter, one in at Lichfield, and one at Ceredigion in mid central Wales. So that those three lieutenant colonels' depots came under me too. So I was in other words, from that point of view, a training brigadier. I also had some responsibilities in conjunction with the officer in charge of records. For senior appointments like RSMs and that sort of thing. When it came to career planning, of course, I had to work in very closely with the AG2, which was the infantry manning branch, and with the military secretaries branch. I think one of the reasons I got the job was that I'd had two appointments in the MS, and I knew how the MS system worked. I do know that because I've turned out one of the factors which led to my being selected for the job. But with 9 battalions dotted all over the world, I used to try and visit each battalion once a year. So that was quite a busy to go and see the commanding officer to discuss my plans of who was going to be his next second in command, quartermasters, company commanders, to interview any young officers who wanted advice or wanted to see me about their discuss their career prospects or what they should do next or anything like that. I also had to maintain, and this is perhaps the trickiest thing of all, get the confidence of the colonels of regiments. The fact was that my predecessor, not for any, I had my boss was the colonel commandant of the Prince of Wales Division, who was a 3-star general. Now, the predecessor had tried very hard. But there were one or two colonels of regiments who were dead against this business. They didn't want Welsh regiments. They didn't want anything to do with the English regiments. And there was some very stormy scene. Not in my time. Very stormy scene. People walking out, and the thing wasn't working. And so one of my main jobs was to try and make the system work. And this meant quite a lot of thought and to get the confidence of colonels of regiments.
Was the issue here the question of regimental autonomy?
To a certain extent, yes. You see, one of the perceived advantages of this was that if you had a regiment, one regiment with half a dozen top-class majors all fitted to command, it would be wrong, from a career point of view, to block those chaps simply because they were in that regiment. And another regiment had a lot of useless officers, and it's quite across the board in company commanders too, and so on. So that one had to try and sell the idea that one wasn't messing about with the essential character of the Germans and Dorset regiment, but there were going to be times when an officer from another regiment would have to come in to command a company and that sort of thing. And this was quite difficult to sell to these chaps.
Well, I would imagine also, if you were training brigadier, one of your roles must have been to try and ensure that there was some kind of consistency in the sort of training doing.
I mean, apart from catman, obviously, the recruit had to have exactly the same sorts. We used to discuss the syllabus and so on quite a bit. But, I mean, the basic syllabus was laid down by the Ministry of Defence.
Yes.
But you obviously had to apply it locally because depending on availability of ranges, weather, all sorts of things, there had to be some sort of adaptation. But that was perhaps less of a problem than when it came to officer posting.
Yes.
Anyway, we solved it really by... I persuaded my boss that we would have a meeting of colonels of regiments, and we briefed them the day. We took a lot of time getting up view foils and showing imbalances of quartum and so on, and going right through it all. And then that evening we had a hell of a good dinner party in the mess, lots of booze, and we repeated this a couple of times. And in the end, there was one very, very difficult lieutenant general who I won't mention his name, but I mean, he always used to write me, dear Randall, this. And then suddenly he rang me and said, dear John, and so on. At the end, when I went away, he wrote one of the nicest letters I've ever had, saying that I'm absolutely against you, but I do have to say that you've done a lot for my regiment, and I'm entirely won over to the system. So I'm not trying to be too boastful, but it was just a question of just plain hard work and trying to sell this idea.
So it seems to me the idea you've got here is a flexible career planning within a division,
yes.
An administrative division.
Yes.
Was there any idea of perhaps extending that beyond the division? Because at one time, I think there was an idea that we really ought to have complete and absolute flexibility and have a corps of infantry rather than...
Yeah, well, that was outside my field.
Yes, but this is a step towards that kind of thing, isn't it?
When it came to Lieutenant Colonel's command, of course, it did go outside. I mean, we did provide people to command SAS, for instance, to provide challenge command for the parachute regiment. We provided H. Jones went outside. Not in my time.
Well, quite.
And there were cases where chaps went into other divisions, too.
Mm.
But that was the exception. But generally speaking, majors and below didn't get posted outside the division. At the same time, you had to be careful that you didn't just finish up with a battalion, sort of polyglot lot of people. The battalions, colonel regiments, quite often, and I'd been one myself. You wanted to maintain the character of the thing, so you couldn't dilute it too much, actually.
Well, but you always have a dilemma, don't you? Because on the one hand, you want to maintain the character of the unit for the sake of cohesion and for the sake of a good performance under extreme pressure.
Yes.
And on the other hand, you want to make sure that you do have efficient people being promoted, and that might mean cross-posting.
Yes.
The two things are really...
Yeah, well, it's a balance.
It's a balance, yes.
We had one or two dramas. I mean, one sort of Friday afternoon, there was a signal from the commander of one British corps. He'd been on an exercise, and a battalion had made a real cock of up. It was because that battalion was going to be amalgamated with some other... Two regiments were going to amalgamate. Anyway, this battalion had run down. Anyway, the corps commander... Jackie Harmon, who I'd been, when I was colonel training, he'd been my boss. So he was winding me. He said, the visual brigadier will post in some decent company command or something to that effect. So it was the only weekend, I think. So I said to the boys, right, you can kiss goodbye to the weekend. This is what we've got to do. You get on with it. I will be around. I'm not going to come breathe down your neck, but by such and such a time, I'd like you to try and produce a plan, and I'll go through it. But that was a sort of occasional, that's a sort of thing. But generally speaking, if we had failed, if that situation arose, because we hadn't seen a balanced quality, I suppose it was some reflection on my work that happened. But it was only because we were running down this battalion. Because it was going to amalgamate with the Hampshires, and it was the Gloucesters, actually. They were going to amalgamate, and then a new government, the Heath government, came in, and they stopped the amalgamation. And so we then, so having run it down, because knowing it was going to amalgamate, we then had to rejuvenate it. So this is how the situation arose. It was very interesting. And of course, I had to go to the battalions all over the world. I mean, they were all possible, they played from Hong Kong to Berlin to... Cyprus, all over the place.
Who did you work to? Did you work to the Ministry of Defence, mainly?
Well,
three bosses. Mm.
The chap who wrote my confidential report and my real boss was the Director of Infantry. But then I was also responsible to the Colonel Commandant of the Prince of Wales Division, because... He was a sort of titular chap, but he took a lot of interest in things, and he had a very powerful chap. I mean, my particular boss was a chap called Napier Crittenden, three-star general, a super chap. I got on well with him. And then, because I happened to be stationed in Lichfield, I also had responsibilities to the local district commander for sort of aid to the civil power.
Did that?
So we all had sort of mobilisation roles, practice once in a while. I don't know. We all had to go and man VIPs and that sort of thing. So that again, I mean, I did what was asked of me. A chap called what was his name? I can't remember now. Anyway, he was a chum of mine. Anyway, so he didn't mess me about.
Did you ever have to do anything for the aid of the civil power?
No, we just had the odd tune.
Yeah. Did you have a liaison with the local police for that purpose?
Well, yes, I got. Yes, I did. I was also the garrison commander of Litchfield, which was no. But I did have a certain amount of sort of local liaison things, which was fine. I used to go to the mayor of Birmingham's ball and that. Because I was the sort of senior chap in that area, so I had to do a certain amount of representational things.
Do you remember,
like anybody else had to do with the army.
Was there any serious idea there might be an internal security threat at that time?
No, it wasn't internal. It was really, I think, the main role was in the case of nuclear war, really. If there was a serious damage and that sort of thing, we all had to sort of go and help man the sort of emergency posts and that sort of thing. This was in the early 70s. There was still a Cold War threat there. The perceived threat was not that the citizens of Birmingham were going to rise or riot. It was to do with the potential damage of a Cold War attack. That was the background in which we had various sort of shadow appointments.
What about the possibility of a threat being generated by Irish terrorists? Was there any thought about that?
Well, it was only just beginning, you see. The trouble started in 69. I went to Litchfield in February 71. I don't think there'd been any bomb attacks against targets in Britain. I mean, I still drove around as everybody did it, with a staff car with a pennant and a red, a notable staff car with a plate up and my flag. It was stopped fairly. I did the whole time I was there. It wasn't really until about 74 or something, or 75, that I think things got serious. So I don't remember the IRA being a threat.
You don't remember the police being at all concerned at the possibility of a terrorist threat?
No. The main thing with civil was nuclear war.
Do you remember what you were going to have to do if there was an alert for a possible nuclear attack?
I can't remember now. I think, actually, I was a bit of a spare file. All my staff disappeared. They all had shadow appointments. I don't quite remember what I just don't remember what I did have to do. Really. I hope you won't get to ask that question.
Did you have any responsibility for recruiting?
Oh, very much so, yes.
What were you doing about that at the time? And was recruiting going well?
We had a lot of... I issued directives and things. I went round... spent a lot of time going to all the recruiting offices in my area. And my area went from Plymouth to Reading to Manchester, so, and all over Wales. So... Yes, recruiting was a very important factor. Indeed it was, yes.
Do you remember if you were having any particular difficulties with recruiting at the time, or was it going quite well?
There always had been recruiting difficulties. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to... we weren't in a crisis situation. It also meant... You see, we had the slight paradox that all the office planning and that sort of thing was dealt with. I was responsible.
Yes.
But all the soldier manning was done by the officer in charge of records, who was in York. And so I had responsibilities for recruiting, yes. But then the actual allocation of manpower... two battalions was done by the officer in charge of records. Obviously he and I liaised a lot, and he did all promotions of other ranks up to and including RSMs. But again, he would always, we'd have these joint meetings, promotions to RSMs and our QMSs, but certainly RSMs so he'd always listen to our recommendations. So again, it wasn't clear cut in a way. I had to encourage recruits, get all the many recruits in, but the actual allocation of soldiers to battalions was done by Oscar Rett, depending upon priorities given by the Ministry of Defence.
Where did